Nonetheless, Norman Borlaug got the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in the Green Revolution. And the myth that the Green Revolution saved a billion people from hunger continues to this day. And now we're looking at another Green Revolution. The second step in the construction of the industrial agri-foods complex, or the corporate food regime, if you like, was the structural adjustment policies that the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund imposed on the Third World. Now, back in the 70s, we had an oil crisis, we had an inflationary crisis, we had a farm crisis, we lost half of our farmers here in the United States in the 70s. Earl Butz, Secretary of Agriculture at the time, said, "The world is starving. The American farmer is the most efficient farmer in the world. Plant fence row to fence row." He said, "Get big or get out. We can save the world and we can make some money." Well, that's when we lost half our farmers. Tremendous overproduction ensued, and the price of grain dropped through the floor, and then the banks called back their loans. "We gave you lots of money so you could produce lots of food and buy lots of new land and get real big, just like Earl Buck said. Now, pay up." Right at the time when petroleum became more expensive and the price that farmers were getting for their crops dropped through the floor. So farmers went out of business here. What happened overseas? Countries went bankrupt. Countries that had borrowed for development, borrowed heavily for development, could no longer pay off those loans. So that the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund stepped in and said, "We'll loan you the money to pay off your loan. Well, we'll loan you the money to pay off the interest, at least. But what you've got to do is restructure your economy. And the first thing you've got to do is stop growing food and grow export crops, because you need dollars. You need things that you can sell on the global market so you can get those dollars so you can pay back our banks. So stop growing food. Buy your food. We produce it in the United States anyway. Buy it from us. We've got more food than we know what to do with." They also said, "You'd better dismantle your tariffs, because otherwise our grains are not going to be able to get into your country if you have protective tariffs. So tear them down. While you're at it, get rid of your grain reserves." Now, grain reserves are an incredibly important thing, not just to have grain in times of scarcity, but to stabilize prices. Because when the price of grains go up, if you have a reserve, the government can just release grain onto the market and bring the price down. If the price of grain goes down too low for farmers to make it, the government can buy up the grain and raise the price. But if you get rid of your grain reserves, you have no control whatsoever over price. No control over the market. But that's precisely what we wanted them to do, because we wanted them to depend on the global market, not on their own markets. They had to dismantle the marketing boards. These are the boards that control supply. Right? Dismantle those. This was all about, under the discourse of free trade, that everybody was going to eat better if we traded freely around the world and everybody got their food from the global market, where the comparative advantage of food production was supposedly in the United States and Europe and not in the countries of the global south. The third and fatal step in the construction of the industrial agri-foods complex were, of course, the free trade agreements and the WTO, the World Trade Organizations. Because what the free trade agreements like NAFTA, CAFTA, and the rules governing the WTO signatories basically do is that they cement the structural adjustment policies of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank into international law, into treaty, international treaty, which overrides national laws. So now, the countries of the global south, even if they wanted to, would not be able to protect their own agriculture because they would be in violation of the WTO and they would be sanctioned by the United States or by Europe. So what were the results? Well, in the 1970s, the Global South produced a surplus of $1 billion a year in food. Today, they import $11 billion a year in food. Their food systems have been destroyed. Industrial agriculture produces 20% of the world's greenhouse gases. It is the highest polluter in terms of global warming, higher than cars. It uses up 80% of the world's water. We've lost over 70% of the world's agrobiodiversity. To give you an idea, the Philippines, the home of rice, where back in the 19, up into the 1960s, Filipino farmers had 1,200 varieties of rice, just in the Philippines. Any given small farmer would have 15 different varieties growing at one time. And that's just talking about the rice, not about all the other cultivars they had. That's gone. That's all gone now. It's rotting in the seed banks. You need to keep these seeds in vivo. Farmers have to be planting them out every year to keep them alive. We've got them frozen in seed banks. They go bad. They rot. We're not keeping up. We're losing those seeds. We're losing that global heritage. Right? Now farmers grow 2-3 varieties, maybe 4. That's it. Why? Because you can't get credit to plant your own seeds. You can only get credit to plant the company's seeds. So we've lost that agrobiodiversity, which is essential to our resilience in the face of climate change. And we know about the displacement of the peasantry around the world, particularly in this country. Where are the farmers? You know, there's a sick joke amongst older farmers here, because the average age of a farmer in the United States is approaching 60 right now. And the joke is, in 10 years, the average age of the American farmer is going to be dead. Nonetheless, this country is full of farmers. They're standing on the street corners looking for work. They come from Mexico, Honduras, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Colombia, Panama. They've been displaced. They mow our lawns, they pump our gas, they cook our food in the fancy restaurants. Those are farmers. We're surrounded by farmers. They're out of work. This entire time, we've seen a steady consolidation of profit and control of the food system within just a handful of monopolies. The Green Revolution basically transferred $10 billion of wealth to the United States from the Global South, concentrated in corn and soy production. ADM, Cargill, and Bunge now control 80% of the world's grain. Monsanto controls a fifth of the world's seed. Right? These are huge monopoly corporations. Well, there was a study done. It took about 4 years. There were about 400 scientists involved. It's called the ASTID, the International Assessment of Agricultural Science and Technology for Development. The ASTID is very interesting. It was actually a study initiated by the World Bank and Monsanto, because what Monsanto wanted a study that basically proved that GMOs would save the world from hunger. So the World Bank called in different experts, who called in more experts, and the process got rolling. And before you knew it, there were 400 scientists, both social scientists and agronomists and geneticists involved, economists, experts. And they worked for 4 years looking at the problem of food production and hunger. And they came to some interesting conclusions. By the way, has anybody heard of this report, the ASTID? Good for you. Most people haven't heard of it. It's been shelved. Why? Well, they didn't like the results. What did they find? They found that GMOs are a solution looking for a problem. Because the first thing you have to realize about GMOs is that they do not increase yield. Let me repeat that. GMOs do not increase yield. They are not higher yielding. Now, the USDA admits this, and the Union for Concerned Scientists has also published about this. And if you really push Monsanto and Syngenta, they will admit that the seeds in and of themselves are not higher yielding. This is a myth. So to say that you're going to save the world from hunger by producing more simply because you have GMO seeds is patently false, and the scientists know that. And so in their conclusions of the study, they said these don't raise intrinsic yields, and they won't be able to address the problems of climate. Now, why is that? They're working on, Bill Gates has teamed up in an unholy alliance with Monsanto. And they've told us that they're going to produce drought-resistant corn free of charge. It's not exactly free of charge. They have a formula for sharing profits with farmers about this. It's probably not going to work with small farmers, but that's another story. Well, think about climate change for a second. What happens with climate change? Do things just get hotter? Things just get drier? Of course not. The weather becomes unpredictable. We get intense storms. We get flooding. We get outbreaks of insects and pests. We get droughts, yes. We get heat when it should be cold. We get cold when it should be hot. Right? Everything gets disrupted. Are you trying to tell me that the industry is going to produce and find a gene and be able to place it for every single thing which is going to happen and put that in a corn plant and in a soy plant and in a cassava plant and in a rice plant, and on and on and on and on? Of course not. They can't possibly do that. The drought-resistant corn that they've produced thus far only works if there's a drought. If you have a good year, the corn's no good. Your local variety is going to produce more. So you plant their seed. Pray for drought.
You're listening to Eric Holt Jimenez on Food Sovereignty. This is AR. You can order copies of this program by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
I've skipped over one mention about free trade. You know, in Rome, when the G8 gets together, when the FAO gets together, when the Gates Foundation proposes its plan for saving Africa from hunger, they basically talk about three things. One, we need the new technology. We need GMOs. Well, we've seen that this is not as promising as it is made out to be. And we need more free markets. We need to conclude the Doha round. We need to link poor peasants in the global south to the global market without seeing how global markets have destroyed the food systems of the peasantry in the global south. Right? Even the World Bank, in its report on agriculture last year, had to admit that if, in fact, the Doha round was signed and we liberalized trade around the world in agriculture, the benefits to fully liberalize trade in agriculture would be primarily for the North. 90% of the benefits, of the economic benefits of liberalized trade, would go to the global North, not the global South. And when you work out the numbers, it works out to about $2 per poor farmer per year. That's less than a penny a day in benefits, thanks to free trade. So is it any wonder why the African Union doesn't want to sign the Doha Agreement? Free trade is not an answer to hunger. It's one of the problems. It produces hunger. We don't have free trade in this country. Do you think we respect the WTO? With $300 million in subsidies? We subsidize here. They can't subsidize down there. That's not free trade. That's not a level playing field. We know very well that free trade destroys agriculture. And that's fine. As long as it's not ours, it's being destroyed. What we have to realize is that the answer to the hunger crisis, and to the agricultural crisis, and to the crisis of poverty around the planet, is in fact smallholders, small farmers. People are hungry because they're poor. Most of the hungry people in the world are poor farmers. If you rebuild their agriculture and you give them a fair shake in the market, you will eliminate poverty and you will eliminate hunger. You know, peasant farmers feed at least half the world. You don't think about that. Think that the North feeds the South. No, the peasant farmers still feed half the world on a subsistence basis, on a local basis. Basically, poor people feed poor people. But what happens? They get killed in the market. So what happens is the peasant farmer, most of whom are women, produces a crop. It might not be great. Maybe it's a ton per hectare. Maybe it's more. Maybe it's 5 tons per hectare. It doesn't matter because they have to sell the whole thing right away because they're poor. And they've got to pay off debts because they don't get credit, cheap credit. They get it from many money lenders at usury rates. They don't have subsidies. They don't have guaranteed prices. They get slammed. They sell cheap. Within a few months, they're buying that same food back again, but they're buying it back dear. 3, 4, 5 times the price. That's why they're poor. That's why they're hungry. You wonder how farmers can be hungry? That's how they can be hungry. You want to end hunger? You've got to fix that. They can produce 10 tons per hectare, but if you don't fix that, they're still going to be hungry because they're still going to be poor. So we have to rebuild farm economies around the world, including here. They're the key to the world's food security. They're key to conserving our agrobiodiversity and rebuilding our agrobiodiversity. They're a sanctuary for non-GMO agrobiodiversity. You know, when GMOs finally implode, where are we going to go for our genetic material? Not to the seed banks. Those are rotting. No, we've got to go to the peasantry. They are the living seed banks for the genetic heritage of this planet. So if we want a future, we better protect our peasants. We better protect our small farmers. They are the ones who are going to cool the planet. They don't produce all these emissions. They sell locally. They rely primarily on organic material for fertilization, which means that they actually capture carbon in the soil rather than emitting carbon and rather than emitting nitric oxide. They're cooling the planet. We need them. So that was all the depressing news. Now I'll give you the good news. The good news is that, in fact, people have been fighting back. People haven't just stood by passively as the corporate food regime destroys their livelihoods and destroys their food systems. They've been fighting back. I was privileged enough to work with a movement called Campesino a Campesino, which was a farmer-to-farmer movement for sustainable agriculture in Latin America. These were farmers who had been run over by the Green Revolution and whose livelihoods had been destroyed. And as a last-ditch effort, decided to give sustainable agriculture a try again. So they revived their traditional systems and improved upon them through small-scale experimentation. Very simple things that they were able to do to build up organic material, increase crop diversity, use conservation techniques, soil and water conservation techniques. And it spread. It spread throughout Latin America, jumped into the Caribbean, jumped to Cuba, where it really exploded. moved into Africa, into Asia, and parallel movements, similar movements, have been taking place over the last 20 years.